97.1 FM Talk Podcast.
Wiggins America.
I am not a number. I am a free man.
Wiggins America.
The only thing I'm going to need from you guys right now is a cup of coffee.
Wiggins.
Today's global economy waits for no man.
America.
Today's global business climate is like,
whatever, dude.
Hey. Politics is a dirty game. I'm not sure we want to play.
There are forces here at work that you couldn't possibly understand.
You have no idea how high up this goes.
Welcome to Wiggins America.
About what he's doing.
Anyone who is eligible for the program as legislated by Congress is not being cut off from the program. The people are being cut off the program, the people are ripping off the program. Just like unemployment benefits, you've got people ripping off the program. Just like happened in so many of these programs where people, so people getting Social Security benefits that are eligible for. We can't continue that way.
Thank you for that kind introduction, Steve Moore. Of course, that is a clip that I chose to play because of the budget talks. Let's talk about the rest of the show, and then we'll talk about that. We have Giano Caldwell, that is an interview that I did earlier this week, coming up in the next break, talking about crime really across the country, but specific to Chicago and St. Louis, for that matter. And then Chris Woolsey with some streaming recommendations, and then Pacific Legal talking about nationwide injunctions, where that whole thing is headed. This is actually a stacked show, and not because I'm good at my job, but because it just so happened to be a week, Memorial Day weekend, that was full of guests. It just happened that way. So anyway, this budget bill, you really want to talk about this? Because I do. I am not a huge fan of it, even though there are a lot of things in it that I really like. Now, let me explain. I'll try to be unbiased here and explain both sides. Not Democrat-Republican, but both sides in the Republican Party of why some people are really against this and some people are really for it. It ultimately has passed the House. That doesn't mean it's going to pass the Senate. And unfortunately, you'd hope that maybe the Senate would go and clean it up a little bit and make it even better. But what we know about the Senate, they'll probably make it worse is the problem. So this is maybe the best version of this thing that you're going to get at this moment. And here are some ways in which it is good. As Stephen Moore outlined at the beginning there, if the economy grows at the pace that the Trump administration thinks it will, due to deregulation, due to tariffs, due to green card, gold cards, I mean, bringing money back to the United States is a big theme here, and cutting taxes on people and this and that would spur the economy and energy prices and all that. So the House Budget Committee and the Oversight Committee and whatever that do the projections, they do one projection. Trump administration is doing a different projection. So if Stephen Moore is right from that clip at the beginning, then things will actually be better than is listed. But some of the things that are in this is that it permanently extends lower income tax rates, expands the standard deduction. If you're going to use that, I don't use that. Increases the child tax credit. Okay, that's nice. Makes overtime pay tax-free. Makes tipped income tax-free. These are campaign promises, so whatever you think of them. Expands the savers credit for ABLE accounts. This is disabled dependents and long-term care-oriented. Enhances deductions for seniors. I mean, this is just stuff. Protects education support, so some of that's good. Expands earned income eligibility. Encourages work, not welfare. So there are some cuts. And encourages, I think, demands that there be Medicaid work requirements and cuts the availability of SNAP benefits to people who are able-bodied. All of that, super, super necessary. The only problem is, as it always comes back to for me, is the budget. We've gotten to the point now where we don't even talk about trying to balance the budget. There are representatives, and you know their names, well, some of them, Warren something from Ohio is one of them that I didn't know that he voted against this bill. But Thomas Massie is the other main one. And you can call them grandstanders if you want to. They kind of are. But what they're trying to do, in my opinion, because Chip Roy is an interesting, different guy. He's really, really conservative fiscally, and he will push for serious cuts to everything, cutting the Green New Deal. I'm still looking to see if they cut all of the Green New Deal out of this. If they didn't, that is a freaking crying shame, because why wouldn't you do that? But because you ran against the Green New Deal, you stupid idiots. But we'll see if they did, basically because of Chip Roy, and he ended up voting for it, so I'm hopeful. But the Massies of the world, they're trying to move the Overton window, because again, we're not even talking about trying to balance the budget, or when we do, it's a projection that maybe we'll get to, I kid you not, this is what's in this bill, that we'll get to a budget deficit in 2030. So until then, you're going to spend about $2 trillion more into the debt. They haven't codified a lot of the DOGE stuff into this. I'm told that that will be a part of the rescissions packages that will come afterwards. And if that's the case, okay. But I just don't understand why you wouldn't include a lot of that stuff in this. It may just be too big. You're trying to herd too many cats. I understand. But some of the stuff that is in there is good. There's probably some stuff that I'm looking into that's really good for business, although I don't want to report it until I know for sure. But we have to be talking about balancing the budget. We're not, the Republicans aren't even talking about it anymore. It used to be Republicans said this, Democrats said that, and Republicans were the fiscally responsible ones, and Democrats just wanted to spend, spend, spend. This was just Republicans negotiating with Republicans. They weren't even trying to get Democrats on board, because they were a hard no across no matter what. You knew that going in. So, okay, so we're not even going to have the discussion about trying to balance the budget anymore? Oh, no, we are, but it's going to start in 2030, which means that that's a whole new Congress, a whole new president, and we have no idea what they're going to vote for between now and then, and they'll probably just remove it anyway. This is what Congress constantly does, is they constantly project future deficits, but right now, yeah, we're spending more than we make. Here's the only good news on that front. Democrats' version of this spent about $2 trillion more than we make. So $2 trillion to the debt every single year. Republicans, it's about $400 billion to the debt every single year and dropping a little bit until you get to 2030. So they'll spend a lot less to the deficit than the Democrats did, but it's still gigantic. It does accomplish a lot of the legislative agenda for Trump, though. So there are good things in here, not just for Trump, but for Americans. All right, I'm going to get off my soapbox. Let's get to our guests. Stick around.
Wiggins America.
Well, that's Mayor Brandon Johnson. We have a guest on the line right now who probably has a lot to say about that, Giano Caldwell. You probably recognize him, Fox News political analyst. He's got a book called The Day My Brother Was Murdered, My Journey Through America's Violent Crime Crisis. And we're going to talk about that because you're from Chicago, Giano. Thanks for being here.
No, thank you for having me. I appreciate the ability to talk about my hometown.
Let's talk about the story that really has sort of come together in your book. This comes from your 18-year-old brother, Christian, who was gunned down on the south side of Chicago. Give us kind of a background of how this happened.
Well, my brother, Christian, was murdered. Innocent kid murdered on June 24th, 2022 on the south side of Chicago, as you mentioned. My life changed forever after that, many of my family members as well. When discussing the book, in it, I take stories from across the nation, people who lost their lives due to violent crime in some way, shape, or form. And we write about what happened to them, what their life was like, the people who did it. We talk about solutions to the issues. I implement commentary from people like Sean Hannity, Dr. Drew Pinsky, John Walsh from America's Most Wanted. And we tell their stories because everyone knows it's bad out there. You're playing Chicago soundbites right now. People in Chicago know that many are in fear of their lives. as it is often said, this person was murdered because they were at the wrong place at the wrong time. But being at the wrong place at the wrong time in Chicago could be you laying in your bed and a bullet comes through your window. Nowhere safe there. And it's unfortunate.
Gianna, what is the story? This is 2022. Your brother is 18 years old. How did this happen to him?
Yeah, he was standing in front of a restaurant, I believe it was, on that 24th of that morning. And he was standing next to some folks. He wasn't the target. And they wanted a guy who apparently had these gangs had a fight on Facebook of some sort, and they were after the guy. So my brother was standing next to him. They shot him, the guy, multiple times. My brother may have been hit, I think, twice, but he was the only one that didn't live. They also shot a young lady as well. So it's just like in places like Chicago, these kind of things happen on a regular occurrence. I write about it in my book, The Day My Brother Was Murdered. A six-month-year-old was murdered in Chicago on that same day, miles from my brother, not that far away. This is what has happened to places that vote in particular elected officials, particularly progressive or very liberal, who believe in allowing criminals to have free reign. That's when they implement policies like, for example, in Chicago, a no-chase policy, where police have to call into their supervisors in order to pursue a suspect on foot or in vehicle. By the time you get the supervisor on the line, I'm sure the suspect is already gone. Or the Safety Act, which I'm sure you have talked to your listeners about many times before, which is really shaping Illinois into Gotham City, especially places like Chicago, where law and order doesn't seem to be something that Mayor Brandon Johnson respects. And it reflects in his poll numbers, considering the fact that he's the lowest polling mayor in Chicago history.
Incredible. Gianna Caldwell, founder of the Caldwell Institute for Public Safety, also Fox News political analyst, and his book is called The Day My Brother Was Murdered, My Journey Through America's Violent Crime Crisis. Gianna, when I first started here at 97.1, it was Saturday mornings, and I was basically just a news reporter for Top of the Hour. And I can't tell you, I would look it through the AP stories that came through overnight, and every night, this would have been every Friday night, it was just murder after murder after murder, to the point that you don't even report on it because it's just the same thing. And so the problem is so much worse than it even appears, because the reporting just becomes numb to it too, where you're like, look, I can't just report that there's, well, another five murders last night. But our politicians, I know what's happening in St. Louis because we're here, but in Chicago, are the politicians the leaders of the city? Are they even paying it lip service anymore? Or is it just kind of like, we're not even talking about it?
You know, to your point, I don't believe it's just those who gather the news have become numb to it. The people in the city have become numb to it.
Yeah.
There's so much potential in the city of Chicago, but unfortunately, it's scattered throughout graveyards throughout the city. That's where the potential is, largely, because people are being killed day in and day out. You ask, do the politicians care? I would say no. Why? Because they know that their people are being murdered. There's black bodies littered throughout the streets of Chicago. They've been derelict in their duty, and they've enabled crime. Look at people like the former district attorney there, the Cook County prosecutor, Kim Fox. How many cases did she blow off and say, hey, we're going to drop these cases? Include, I think it was over maybe 40, 50,000, including rape and murder. Like, these are very serious issues, and the elected officials there have paid lip service. Maybe they say they want to fix the issue, but then they vote in more liberal policies that enable literal death in that city, and it's quite unfortunate, I must say.
Gianna, one of the things you talk about in your book is black-on-black crime. These are topics that have been taboo, but I'm encouraged to see people just saying, look, I don't care that they're taboo. We have to talk about these things if we're going to solve them. How do you address that topic, both in the book and just in life?
Well, if we're going to use another example of your neighboring place, Chicago, most of the people that are being murdered there are black. Most of the offenders are black. And we're talking about black men murdering black men. And that's where we are. And yes, it's been a taboo subject, but the truth of the matter is you can't solve a problem if people don't talk about the problem, if you don't try to understand a problem, if you don't try to decipher what the solutions are to that problem. those who just choose to capitulate to political correctness are just a part of the problem. And that's been the issue. They want to make be the language police when the facts are just the facts. And, you know, I would hate to say it, but it is true. My community is upside down because of our own people hunting down each other and killing each other. Now, does that mean that I should just put shame on them and not give them any hope? Absolutely not. You can change things around if you begin to vote for people, perhaps Republicans, because it's been a one-party city and a one-party state for many, many years, who believe in law and order, who are willing to implement policies to reverse things like recidivism. You know, we want to bring companies back into those cities, fill those jobs. And what happens when you have violence out of control? You get people like the billionaire founder, a hedge fund founder. What's his name? He moved to Miami. I can't think of his name right now. It escapes me. But
we're nodding. Like we know what you're talking about, though. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, you get major companies that leave, and, you know, there's direct and indirect negative job impact. And that's where we come to in these particular cities. It hurts everyone.
Okay, you mentioned solutions a couple times.
Ken Griffin is his name.
Ken Griffin. Thank you.
Yeah.
And you can really approach this question from a couple of different angles. You could say, what is the solution for the average person who lives in Illinois, or lives in any city really, but lives in Illinois, Chicago? What can they do? But also, what could a politician do differently at the state level, at the governor's level, at the mayor's level?
I mean, twofold. As a citizen, I would, especially if you're in a high crime area, I would go get a gun, get trained, get licensed. And maybe you want to get licensed first, but, you know, in the reverse order, be able to protect yourself, be aware of your surroundings at all times, especially if you're in one of those high crime areas. As a politician, what could you do? You can not defund the police, as an example. I mean, that sounds like a rational, logical thing, right? Am I wrong about that?
It seems pretty simple.
Don't defund the police. Yeah, I mean, it should be very simple. You should hold criminals accountable. You can use the current laws on the books, or you can add more time on that as a solution. Additionally, we can talk about job opportunities in those areas. We can talk about financial literacy. We can talk about literacy in general. We can talk about education in our schools. We can talk about cutting off the school-to-prison pipeline. These are all important issues in which I tackle in my book, The Day My Brother Was Murdered, My Journey Through America's Violent Crime Crisis, because it was a needed discussion. And it's quite unfortunate that my brother, Christian, his legacy isn't him having children and having graduated college and done well for himself and raised a family. It's unfortunate that that's not going to be his legacy. He had no kids, and he was going to go to college soon, but that didn't happen. But his legacy will be the Caldwell Institute for Public Safety, me going after George Soros-funded prosecutors, ensuring that they are not reelected in many of these jurisdictions, that we got safety and security in our neighborhoods, that we're holding politicians accountable, and there's a bullet pulpit where people's lives can be saved. If you're interested in information on the Caldwell Institute for Public Safety, I ask you to go to caldwellinstitute.org. Again, that's caldwellinstitute.org. For anyone who might have experienced a family tragedy, we have information there in our tabs that you can learn how to pitch a story to the press, because oftentimes there's so many of these murders, people are fighting for press time just to get justice for their family. If you're going through a mental health crisis, we have a manual put together by Dr. Drew Pinsky, which people might know from Celebrity Rehab, Teen Mom, and other places. If you want to learn how to work with the police and the prosecutors, we have manuals written by police and prosecutors on how to work with these organizations to best advance the case of justice for your family. There's a lot of material there, and I encourage people to go to CaldwellInstitute.org.
Well, I appreciate everything you're doing, Giano Caldwell. The book, which will release on June 24th, is called The Day My Brother Was Murdered, My Journey Through America's Violent Crime Crisis. Hopefully we can catch up with you again, okay? Got a short time here to talk to Chris Woolsey. Anytime I get a chance, I like to bring him on. Chris Woolsey in L.A., how are you, sir?
I am well. How about you, good sir?
I'm doing fine. It's Memorial Day weekend. I think we're all feeling pretty good about heading into summer now, so love that. Although all of a sudden it's hot here in St. Louis, too, so I don't know about you guys.
It is hot in LA. I mean, by LA standards, for sure. Yeah, we're in the high 80s in my area. So yeah, it's definitely officially in the summer-esque season.
Yeah, I don't know why. It's just like summer hit all of a sudden, and I'm just sort of realizing that out loud with you right now.
Yep.
But, Chris, you know, there was a news story that I saw that I said, you know what, I want to ask you about that before we get into some good titles and stuff for this weekend. But Ben Affleck, Rob Lowe, multiple like big stars from all over the political spectrum are just saying the same thing. They're saying, look, LA and California, it used to be like the hub for all productions. And now, because of, I don't know, politics or tax incentives or whatever it is, they're saying we need to do more in California to bring the movie industry back. You're in LA. I just thought I'd mention that to see what your thoughts are on that.
Yeah, I mean, I've been seeing a lot of that talk as well. And, you know, I have to say, I fully understand that governing is a difficult job. I don't pretend to be smart enough to understand how all of that works. But living in Los Angeles for the last 30 years, I know very much that it is an industry town. If you are not directly involved in the entertainment industry, you're probably involved in an industry that's right next door to that. Mm-hmm. And so all of those economics work together so that all of us in Los Angeles can put food on the table, can provide for our families, can have fulfilling jobs and live together as a community. And so when you have a town and a county really that of, you know, over 10 million people who depend on the entertainment industry in order to do all the things we need to do to be, you know, citizens in this community, it is really frustrating when you see jobs being lost, when you see productions moving overseas or to other countries, and think there has to be something we can do in order to keep those here. Again, I'm not suggesting I have the answers, but I am saying that the entertainment industry is extremely important to Los Angeles and to Southern California in general, and we need to be making every effort we can to keep as much production as possible in this area.
Well, I'm really glad to hear that you said the industry a couple times there, because Chris, I don't know if you know this, but the weekday show that I'm on, the Annie Fry show, they refer to me as being in the industry, or at least currently or in the past, many times. And they always do it with sarcasm, like saying the industry is something we don't do here in St. Louis. But in LA, that is what you call it, right?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, without a doubt. I mean, when people say, what do you do for a living? They say, well, I work in the industry.
The industry.
I mean, everybody just knows. They just know what that means. And by the way, I always consider you to be an entertainment insider, Ryan.
Thank you.
There is no irony in that whatsoever when I refer to you in conversations.
Well, yeah, this is why people come to Wiggins America, is to hear the entertainment part of it. let's talk about some titles since it's Memorial Day weekend. Vizio, you are connected to Vizio. They've got some good titles, like I've got The Hurt Locker here. And In Harm's Way. I remember Hurt Locker. I don't know In Harm's Way.
In Harm's Way is great. Emile Hirsch.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Phenomenal actor. It's actually based on a true story. It's about a... So Doolittle's Raiders bombed Tokyo after Pearl Harbor as sort of retribution. And on his way out, this fighter pilot was shot down over occupied China. And true story, this pilot crash landed, this village of Chinese citizens grabbed him, took him into their village and hid him while the Japanese were looking. They knew he was there. They knew there was no body in the plane. They knew that somebody was hiding him. And so they went on this terror rant to try to get them to give him up. It's a heroic story. It's really beautiful. The Hurt Locker, obviously, oh my gosh. I mean, Catherine Bigelow's masterpiece, in my opinion. I think it is a phenomenal film. Really was one of the first movies that I think everybody sat up and said, oh my gosh, Jeremy Renner is a movie star. Like he's a leading man and we need those right now. I love that film. I think it's phenomenally written and the production value is through the roof.
How about some action titles?
We have a lot. One of my all-time favorite action films, and I do not say that lightly as somebody who loves action films maybe more than any other genre, and that is the 2004 classic Denzel Washington, Man on Fire. It is spectacular. It's about a guy who Denzel Washington plays this ex-CIA operative who's just kind of come to the end of himself. He's had a rough life, battling alcoholism, et cetera, et cetera. Thinks he's going to take his own life. And out of nowhere, this little girl comes into his life and just sort of reinvigorates the fire, the passion for life. And he just loves this little girl. She ends up getting kidnapped. And as he's the bodyguard for her family in South America, and he decides he is going to do whatever it takes to get her back to safety. And man, does he goes on a tear. It is a phenomenal film. Highly recommended.
Yeah. Man on Fire is an awesome movie. Denzel Washington is one of those guys. Liam Neeson's another one. They had about a 15-year span where no matter what they put out, I'm like, I'm seeing it. Jake Gyllenhaal is another one. Like anything, he's still doing that for me. If he comes out with a movie, I'm like, I'm going to go see that movie. But Man on Fire
is
right in the center of that like prime Denzel Washington action stuff. And that's a great film.
Oh, yeah. Yep. I'm with you on all those guys. They're just spectacular. Liam Neeson. I mean, to quote him, they are men with particular sets of skills.
Yeah, exactly. Chris, tell everybody where they can watch some of these films we've been talking about. The Hurt Locker, In Harm's Way, Man on Fire.
You can watch those on Vizio WatchFree+. If you have a Vizio TV, you literally just turn it on and the homepage, click on the WatchFree+ app. If you don't have a Vizio TV, do not despair. You can watch as well. You just go to your favorite app store, download the free Vizio mobile app to your favorite mobile device, create a free account, and you can watch over 300 live streaming channels with all of your favorite entertainment. And of course, everything on WatchFree+ is always free.
Chris, thanks so much for your time and your recommendations and your little news update on LA there. Love that you're there, and you can give us those updates as well. We are going to take a break now and talk with, on the other side of the break, Joe Esposito from Pacific Legal about all these nationwide injunctions and what the Supreme Court's doing. We'll be right back. This was from about a month and a half ago because it really stuck with me when I saw it, the way that he phrased it. He's really good at messaging, Stephen Miller is. He'll just walk out to the press gaggle and go, let's go, just like Trump does. But here's what the tweet says. It says, there are 677 local district judges. Under current procedure, the president needs unanimous consent from all 677 of these judges to implement a major decision. If just one communist out of 677 unelected judges disagrees, the action is frozen nationwide. This is not democracy. What he's talking about here is nationwide injunctions. And that's why Joe Lupino Esposito from Pacific Legal is here to talk about the hearing that happened at the Supreme Court last week. Hi, Joe.
Hey, how are you?
Good. So let everybody kind of catch up on what the Supreme Court did last week. This hearing that happened, they were talking about nationwide injunctions, even though they were also talking about birthright citizenship. Am I right?
That's right, yeah. And, you know, a lot of the headlines said this is a case on birthright citizenship, which isn't wrong, but it's not exactly right either. So this really is a case on nationwide injunctions. And that was where the core of the argument came from. You know, the Trump administration was arguing that in this instance and in many instances, it's inappropriate for a district court judge just on his or her own to issue a nationwide injunction. And that is really no way for the court system to handle actions coming from the executive branch, or for that matter, from the Congress, if that were to be the case, because that's just one person. It's not really the way that the separation of powers ought to work.
But as of now, that is the way it works, right? If one judge says, no, the president did something that I don't like or that I find illegal, and they you come up with whatever justification, that freezes everything.
That's right, yes. And they can do that nationwide injunction, even if it's a single plaintiff in a single district. They could say, you know what, this doesn't stand for anywhere in the country. And, you know, we've seen this, you know, across the board on both sides of the aisle. You know, during the last administration, there was the some of the student loan cancellations. There were some nationwide injunctions on that as well. So, you know, the Biden administration didn't love it that much either. But I think just more recently, we've seen a lot more headlines, you know, potentially because of just the overall more general, if you will, aggressive nature of the Trump administration to really move a lot of the balls forward here for their agenda, that they're getting a lot more pushback in the courts.
So this is something that obviously you just said, both sides have used it. Does that mean the Supreme Court, did they tip their hand as to how they're ruling on that? I mean, what happened in that hearing? I guess we should catch up on that.
Right. So it was a pretty long one because you had some of the states arguing. You had other people arguing, other immigrant groups as well, arguing against the Trump administration. And the bottom line of that is that it was really hard to read the tea leaves on this because, you know, the underlying law would be a really tough one for the Trump administration to win just based on current precedent when it comes to birthright citizenship. So then the question is, well, if we're only looking at it as a procedural matter when it comes to these nationwide injunctions, do we need to know how strong the case is underneath, or should we just say, look, these things are a bad idea in general? Or should we do something somewhere in between? Like, you know, maybe it stands here, but in general, we discourage them, or vice versa. I mean, it's really hard to tell because you have justices like Justice Gorsuch who have always been, at least they've always indicated that they do not like the idea of a nationwide injunction. But there are some instances where they could be appropriate. And they did talk about that as well. You know, could there be a class action suit? Would that be an appropriate way of doing it? Or could it be more appropriate if it was a circuit court actually doing it and not just a district court or the Supreme Court itself? That's something the Trump administration says, well, you know, if the Supreme Court issues it, that makes a whole lot more sense. But an individual district judge, that's not what we're into.
We're talking with Joe Lupino, Esposito Pacific Legal Foundation's Legal Policy Deputy Director. So let's say, well, I guess we should find out the timeline first. When does the Supreme Court come back on this? And then you kind of talked through some of the possibilities there, but do you see them, could they actually make a ruling on national injunctions that, you know, yeah, we're not going to do this anymore?
Yes. Yeah, so as for the timeline, we expect a decision sometime in June. That's when these sort of late, especially okay. This one is the latest argument they have scheduled, at least as of right now. The decision will come sometime in June, perhaps sooner, but most likely will be late into the month, if not early July. And then, yeah, you know, their ruling could be specific to the nationwide injunctions, or, I mean, you know, Adam Liptak, the New York Times, has a theory that, you know, he thinks there's a 20% chance they come back and say, you know what? We actually need to hear the underlying case before we can make a decision. Come back and do re-argument. And they may be working this summer. Who knows? But we'll find out what that would look like. You know, most likely they'd wait until the fall. But still, you know, there are a few different possibilities here because it's such an oddball issue that to be argued and not to argue on the merits is a little different, a little unconventional. But it's certainly bringing up an important issue that's been debated on both sides for a very, very long time.
Well, let's talk about birthright citizenship then, since that's the actual case. So you think that they probably will do this separately? Well, they'll talk about nationwide injunctions in one on one hand, and then birthright citizenship separately, right?
Right. That's what it seems like the most likely outcome. Now, there's also, again, hate to be a lawyer about it, right? But there's a sort of in between land, even in that, in which they can say, you know, perhaps they come up with some sort of test or some other kind of ruling to say, well, they're allowed, but here's when they can be used. And they come up with a test, and then that way they can decide in this instance, you know, therefore we're going to allow it to be upheld and then continue the case underneath, or vice versa, right? So there's a few different ways to go about it. It may involve some analysis of the underlying issue, because that's really what the judge is determining when they make these injunctions, that they are they're sort of more likely than not that the plaintiff will win when they get one of these injunctions.
So with birthright citizenship, and tell me if I'm wrong here, but just kind of summarizing, you know, assuming somebody's tuning in that most people are going to know what this is, but it's if you have a baby on U.S. soil and you're not even a citizen yourself, the baby is automatically granted United States citizenship, right?
Yes, that's correct.
And so that is not the way almost any other country in the world does it. And the argument is that that's actually not the way that our founders intended it either, that we've been misinterpreting it.
Right. Yeah, that is definitely the argument from the Trump administration. There are some other related cases that have gone over the years where the courts have ruled that, no, it does in fact mean that once you are born here, you are born here. And that's sort of the beginning and the end of the analysis. So the precedent right now, as it stands, is against the administration. That's not to say that the court couldn't rule otherwise. They've certainly done that on a number of cases. But right now, that's where the precedent stands, which is, of course, the argument from the other side on this, saying, look, precedent is very clear on this. It makes sense to do a nationwide injunction because there's not too much of a question. And that would be true, irrelevant of what the end result would be, because even if they get to the end and the Supreme Court says, as a matter of fact, the Trump administration is right, there could be some real justification for a district court doing that just because of the way we've been practicing nationwide injunctions for so long.
Is it, I'm sort of asking you to speak on behalf of Pacific Legal here, Joe. And this may be your opinion or the foundation's opinion entirely, but are nationwide injunctions being, even if not in this case, are they being abused right now by judges?
It seems like they are definitely at least being overused for the most part. And look, there are definitely cases that we have filed that where we wish we could have gotten one, right? it's certainly a case where we think, you know, ours are good, maybe the other ones aren't as good. There's certainly a use for them. But I think part of this analysis will come down to what is the underlying problem and does it really need to be an emergency, which is a large part of that question as well. Because you'll see some of these issues when it comes to an injunction go up to the Supreme Court on an emergency basis, and they may turn around and say, no, we're going to let it stand, or we will not grant it, you know, what either direction may be. More likely, if it's not being granted, they'll say, we won't grant it because this is not an emergency. If this thing goes into effect and gets reversed later, No big deal, right? So that, again, I think will wind up being part of that analysis, is how important is this? So you had, in this case, the states arguing, well, how can we figure this out if this were to stand? And, the Solicitor General of New Jersey was the one arguing on behalf of the states, saying, well, what if they're born in a state where they are a citizen, they are not a citizen, but in New Jersey they would be considered a citizen. So when they move in, are they now a citizen? How does this work? So it presented an interesting practical problem, to say the least. So that may come into play with what they ultimately decide, is doing that type of analysis of how quickly did this actually need to get decided.
Yeah, we'll have to close on this because we're out of time. But this is what's so interesting to me, is that in a case like this, there are times, like you said, that nationwide injunctions do seem appropriate, but if they're just being misused or overused, that seems like a really difficult decision that the Supreme Court, they might agree that it's being overused, but then how do you fashion a judgment that says, well, here's the times you can use it and when it's not? That just seems tough to me.
Yeah, it's very tough. I mean, like I said, anytime they create one of these tests or something like that, it's always difficult for the lower courts to interpret, or sometimes they just decide they don't know how to, and they do their own thing anyway. That would definitely be tough to do. We'll see how it turns out, but that's going to be the difficult question here for the court, which is why there's a high probability they could wind up coming back and say, you know what, we need to make a decision on the merits as well. So we'll see where it leads.
Joe Lupino Esposito from Pacific Legal, love what you guys do, and thank you for the time today. If you want to listen to the whole interview, if you tuned in right at the end here and you missed the beginning of our talk with Joe, or really anything from the show, get the podcast.
Get more at 971talk.com.